Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Big Gym Show is sponsored by Maul and Brawl. Maul and Brawl is the best men's skin and beard care products on the market right now. Maybe. How do I know? Because it's mine. 100% owned by me. Tried and tested by me. Whether you've been mauling in the office or brawling in your bed, Maul and Brawl is for you. We've got a shower gel which is scented dark honey and tobacco. The moisturiser has a scent of ivory musk, and the beard oil will make your beard feel smooth and silky and smelling like whiskey. It comes in three packages. The Simple Man, which is the shower gel. The Modern Man, which is the shower gel and the moisturiser. Or the Caveman, which is the shower gel, moisturiser and beard oil. To order, go to maulandbrawl.com. and type in the code BIGGYM10 for 10% off. Maul and Brawl. For men that maul.
Big Jim is wearing his heels.
So I think tomorrow is the anniversary of being named the most hated item of swimwear in the UK, which is like an enormous badge of honour. While most swimwear brands focused on swimming, we've become a swimwear brand that's focused almost exclusively on sports that don't have anything to do with the water. I was rattled, Jim. Like, I was fucking rattled. My mum is sort of my accountant, and Dad sat us down, and they're like, "Mate, if this keeps going, you're gonna be down $1 million." We got an order from the royal family for Christmas, and he goes, "Oh, mate, it's the royal family. We didn't charge them anything." It's like, "What the?" I go, "Mate, have you seen their houses?"
On this episode, I'm joined by Chief Smuggler, a good friend of mine, a brilliant business been built by brilliant people. It's the powerful Adam Linford. Brilliant to have you. Let's do a little intro.
Yep.
For the millions that are listening. Some might be watching. I'll give them a wave on there. You can watch this as well on YouTube. Have a look at yourself. You look, Linny looks amazing. So Adam Linford, CEO, owner. What is it? CEO of Budgie Smuggler?
I go with Chief Smuggler.
Chief Smuggler there is the go. One on the email. So he's in the studio today. And if you could see him, he looks $1 million because you've got the chili shirt on.
That's it.
It's lovely. Have you got your smugglers on?
I've got the underwear on.
All right.
Yeah.
So it's not just, I'm not going to say the S word. It's not just
Speedo style swimwear. Yeah.
Speedo.
Yeah. Or smuggler style swimwear.
Smuggler. How much do you hate the Speedo? Or is that a good thing?
No. Like, I think one of our goals at Budgie Smuggler is to replace the word Speedo in the English language. So we get plenty of mentions as in the press and stuff as them being Budgie Smugglers instead of Speedos. So chipping away at it. Yeah.
The tide is turning, though, with that terminology, isn't it? As in, more people are using, but I don't know where the turn came. Maybe Mike Tindall in the jungle from a UK perspective.
Yeah.
Wearing his budgies. I don't know whether he put people right. Well, I think some of the celebs, if you call them celebrities, were saying, are they budgies?
Yeah. So I think tomorrow is the anniversary of being named the most hated item of swimwear in the UK, which is like an enormous badge of honour. We beat Crocs, which I actually like as well, and turtlenecks. So they were the top three, and we won by a country mile. And then shortly after that, we made the Oxford English Dictionary alongside the words glamping and wedding tackle. It's a big year.
Let's go. That, I mean, it's a great thing. But who is voting against budgie smugglers in the UK? I can tell you who. Men that can't fill them, either front or back, because they are, and this is a cultural thing, and chatting to Matt Hanson, who was in the studio just before you, like,
his biggest, he wears them,
yeah,
like a lot of the rugby players do. And he just said his biggest worry is that he doesn't feel the front, but he's happy he can feel the back. He's got a decent arse on him. He's quick, he's powerful. He's like a racehorse, isn't he, without the...
Well,
without the extra arm,
one out of two is not bad.
But you need to be a certain shape. I know you've gone down this route of the ordinary rig, which is where my partner in crime linked in with Budgie Smuggler,
yeah,
Andrew Goode. But it takes a special kind of man to fill a pair of Budgie Smugglers properly, no? Or is this the whole idea that it's for any man or woman? I know we've got the women's range as well.
That's it. So when we thought about it at the beginning, like, it was probably similar to, you know, we thought of it a little bit as a swimwear brand and for people who are swimming. And our original focus for the brand was just to get loose in them. So, because it's hard to photograph swimwear in a pool. And then we went to try and sell it like into pools, and it was super competitive. You've got Speedo, Arena, all these companies that own that space. And if you go and talk to a swimmer, you're no chance. They have all the best talent wrapped up. And that's sort of where I learned, I think, the most important lesson in business. And this is important for people who, particularly from a sporting background, are told, like, you've got to compete. You compete at the breakdown, you're competing everywhere. But the first rule in business that I kind of picked up was don't compete. Competition is bad. And so while most swimwear brands focused on swimming, we've become a swimwear brand that's focused almost exclusively on sports that don't have anything to do with the water. and it wasn't like that light bulb just came off. We tried to do the swimming thing and it was like, fuck, this is just too hard. So tools down, what else do we know or like? And, rugby was probably one of the sports or the sport, rugby union and rugby league in Australia, that were at the forefront of it. And now it's like cricket, Formula One, it's got a following, like it's sort of growing, grown from there. And then for me, like, Budgie Smuggler, so it actually started a couple of years before me. There was a bloke called Lockie Harris who started it. And the theory behind the brand was just to get loose in it, like just get loose. And I was traveling through Mexico and I saw these two guys wearing a pair and I got chatting with them. And then when I came back to Australia, I started to help Lockie. This is like 15, 16 years ago. And then, so I was helping out doing the odd thing with Budgie Smuggler. I was just a fan of the brand. And I was working at a bank at a time. I had a job at a year at a bank. I was terrible. I hated it. Just used to spend the whole, there'll be some people listening to this who work at like a big corporate company. And I kind of thought, like, working for a big company was the safe pathway and, you know, to earning decent cash and that sort of thing. So I worked at one of the big major banks in Australia during the GFC, and they were firing like whole floors of people at a time. And I both hated my job and would just stare out. I was such a bad employee. Like, the poor boss had to check my work all the time. I lost $2.5 million of people's money one day. Like, I was shocking. And
good honesty, though.
And I didn't want to be there. Like, it was 9 to 5, luckily, and I was in at 9, out at 5. And the big moment for me was when they just started firing. I think one day 5,000 people got fired. And so working at a big place had always been sold to me as, like, this is the safe thing you can do. It's a good, solid option. And then I see whole floors of people getting fired. And I was like, hang on a second. Like, this is actually the most dangerous place you can be. Because these people, most of them were in their 40s and 50s. And then me, who was hopeless, I was getting promoted all the time because I was the cheapest employee there. I just got out of uni. So I made a call at that time, like, I need to do something else with my life. This is not going to work. And so I started looking for things, and Budgie Smuggler popped up, and also working with the Indigenous mentoring program. Sort of two very different things. But yeah, Lockie was looking to sell. It's a crazy story looking back, but he got a job working for a guy called Kevin Rudd, who came from like nowhere to become the Prime Minister in 2007. And Lockie came up with like the marketing for it, like Kevin 07. And this is
of where? Like, of what country?
Australia.
No Australia. Way.
Yeah, so he was like 27, like I was 20, maybe he's 28, 29, I was 23 or something. And so
how's he packaged it?
Well, so he's gone, would you like to buy a loss-making business selling budgie smugglers in a world where people are wearing board shorts past the knees? And I was like, I'm fucking keen. And then there was a couple of other guys who were with me, and then he wanted more money than any of us could afford at the time. And so fast forward 6 months, and I've been saving money for this or like another business, like just something to do to break out of the like having a normal job. And he had to go for a meeting to meet with Barack Obama and the UN, and was in like a few days' time, and his cousin, a guy Dave Grossman, who was running it for him, was going away as well. And he just called me one morning in Manly, I was hungover, and he said, mate, I need to shift this thing like fast. Can you give us an answer today? And I was like, oh, fuck, I don't know if I can get the money, but let me give us a shot. Managed to pull together the promise of the cash. And it wasn't like totally crazy amount, but it was over a year's salary for me at the time, towards sort of 100 grand Aussie for a business that was turning over like 40,000, I think, and was losing like 5 or 10. So it wasn't like a no-brainer. Yeah, and then like an hour and a half later, the stock turned up at my house. It was about 200 or 300 pairs, a password written on a piece of paper for how to log into the website, and like just a tap on the back, good luck, son. And yeah, we didn't like do any paperwork, anything, not even by email, I don't think. It was just like, we'll sort it out when I'm back from the UN. So yeah, we sorted that out a couple of weeks later, and here we are, like 15 years later. Like I thought it would take off quickly, and I was pretty wrong.
On a side note, where's Lockie?
Lockie's doing well. Yeah. No, Lockie's had a really good career. I saw him in the paper the other day, bought a house for $8.5 million or something. So
he's doing all right.
I think he's going all right. He's a really sharp mind, but he's sort of in and out of businesses. Like he's always like, you know, in for 3, 4, 5 years. That's his sort of cycle. And I saw him when I was at a lunch, he was talking out the other day, and he was saying, like, how do you do it for 15 years? Like, he's like, you're like, his parents have a business in Australia called Harris Farm Markets. It's like, it's a massive supermarket chain. He's like, they've done it for 40 years. How do you keep doing the same thing? But for me, there's been an evolution from like, it was in my bedroom for 7 or so years. So like, then we got an office, you know what I mean?
I was in the office. The one in London or not the one in Australia?
Well, then we got one in Australia.
Yeah.
And then we got one in the UK, and now we're just setting one up in France. So like for me, it's been the first 8 years, actually, I had another full-time job. So I find it interesting but for people out there who might be listening who have like started a side hustle, and you're trying to get ahead, and you're like, it's taking so long. I'm like, how long have you been at it? And they're like, 6 months. I'm like, fuck. You know, like I ran this from my bedroom for 7, 8 years before we got an office. And I thought like, whoa, when I had to move out of my bedroom, that became the office. I was like, whoa, we've made it. And that was like 2016, I think. So, yeah, it was like 8 or 9 years to make a profit, and all the money that I made from my job, I just kept pumping into budgie, and we never had a year that grew more than 100%, but we never had one less than 30% for that 10-year period. So it was kind of just like steady, but you know, if you're doing 50% growth, you know, you're doubling every 2-3 years. You know, you're 4 or 5, like it takes off very steeply. So part of it I knew was just sort of hanging in there, chipping away.
Such a cool brand. it is. And I've been a part of the journey for a few years. Some of the activations we've done with the Rugby Pod, hosted on the boat a few years ago.
The original UK's Most Ordinary Rig.
Exactly. Yeah. The UK's Most Ordinary Rig. I mean, actually, it's genius when you think about it. And I hosted that on a boat on the Thames in a pair of budgies, but I had my suit over the top and I was like, look, I can't. It's minus 35 here in London today. I've not done any glute exercises. For whatever reason, they're not fitting me amazing. And you're like, well, this is the whole thing, because it's like they're meant to be ordinary for ordinary people. You could sell it. And obviously, Goody was there as well, and he could definitely sell it.
Yeah.
15 pints later, we're both knocking about on the boat, off our rockers in some budgie smugglers for what was a brilliant event that you put on. But actually, for all the jokes and the lols around it,
yeah,
a genius bit of marketing, because when you look at speed, it's changed now. My goodness me, let's not talk about...
When you look at brands that emulate budgie smuggler style swimwear.
Yeah. Well, I was going to go more down now in terms of looking what brands do, like Adidas and all these, how they're marketing their stuff. But back in the day, when you look at Calvin Klein, Speedos, and you look at all them things, it was shredded human beings who were in phenomenal shape that only 1% of the population looked like. So how do you appeal to the masses when, especially in the UK, where the weather is miserable, most people feel the minus 35 degree heat. They're not in great shape.
Yeah.
They don't do many glute exercises.
Nah.
So in a pair of budgies, they ain't looking $1 million.
Yeah.
Like they would hope. And so I thought it was great. I thought that bit of marketing was really cool.
I think from our end, like, we're trying to build something like that when you put it on, you feel good. And so we mean that, like, both in the literal sense. And so a reason why a lot of players and that wear it is, like, the product feels good. If you've got good marketing, people will buy something once, but you have to have a good product for people to come back and wear it again and again. So that's one part of it, that literally feeling good. We want you to feel good about the brand, that we look after the environment and things like that. And then also to feel good within yourself. And the sort of start of the Ordinary Rig campaign was around sort of body image, I guess. It was sort of, I think first one in Australia was in 2016. Sort of Instagram was becoming a big thing. And we had these kids come in from Penrith in Western Sydney, like working class area, rat's tails. And they were about to go to schoolies, which is like the big piss up when you finish school in high school in Australia. And I heard one of the kids go, oh, yeah, Matt, we're getting so ripped for schoolies. I was like, whoa, like that's changed a lot since I finished school, because there was no consideration about going to the gym to get shredded before you went away and finished high school. And so obviously, like, male body image had become probably followed in the footsteps of what women have been dealing with for a very long time. So we wanted to do something to counter that. And at the same time, the Victoria's Secret Parade was like huge, and that was just like way over the top. So my brother and I, we debate over who came up with the concept, but we wanted to do something to sort of make fun of the Victoria's Secret campaign and that impossible idea of beauty. And so we came up with a Miss World style pageant, which was Search for Australia and then the UK's Most Ordinary Rig. So all the contestants had to make their own wings. The winner in the UK was a guy called Chris Steele, and he made these giant steel wings. They weighed like 50 kilos. So there's a bit of creative expression and stuff from the guys. But yeah, if the only people who were going to wear budgie smugglers as well were that Calvin Klein, and that's how most swimwear was marketed then, we weren't going to have a business to survive, and I needed to survive. So
you hit the sweet spot. And engaging the rugby teams, was that by fault or design? Or are you from a rugby background, or was it a kind of an organic approach? Because in rugby, that was, I'd say, that has been part of the foundations of the company, and we've seen it branch into Luke and Tom Stoltman, one of the world's strongest men, and his brother.
Yep.
Sorry, Luke, you're more than just his brother. You're an absolute legend as well, but you know what I mean.
They are legends,
yeah. It has, and it's branched out into Formula One as well. But let's just start with the rugby side of it. Like, was that by fault or design?
Yeah, so I played like footy growing up, but when I was about 20, I realised no one was going to pay me to do it. I dislocated my shoulder and I ran the profit and loss on it. And I was like, this isn't looking good. So I was out of the game pretty early. But some of the guys that I played with became, you know, Wallabies. And so, yeah, they were some of the first guys that I got the product to. And it kind of jolted on me that a lot of blokes would wear budgie smuggler style swimwear when they were playing. There's a funny story, actually. I remember it was like 2009, and Berwick Barnes. He used to be
the 10 for
the Wallabies Australia, in Queensland. His manager said, like, Berwick loves the product. Could we meet in town to see if, you know, you might be able to sponsor him? And I'm like, oh, this is amazing. And he sort of asked a couple of questions about the brand. And he's like, you know, we could do something for as little as like $10,000. And I think he just saw my face just go like, it's like, you okay, man? I was like, I don't think
I'm so sorry.
And I just remember I could barely afford, I was running late, so I had to get a taxi from Redfern to the meeting, which was like 15 minutes, and it was like $17. I was like, fuck, I could barely afford the taxi. I'm like, that's stuck. I'm like, oh, mate, I don't think that's going to be possible. And he said, oh, like, how much are you turning over? And I was like, about a year in. So we'd gone from like 40 to 60,000. I'm like, 60 grand. He was like, oh, okay, mate, just get us a couple of pairs and we'll worry about it when you're a bit bigger. And then, yeah, I was really fortunate that Berwick and a lot of those Wallaby players, quite a lot of rugby league players as well, started to wear it and just got a kind of mind of its own. And like in those early days, we were actually selling more, like the orders each day, there was more for it to professional rugby league and rugby union players than there was to just average punters. That was the kind of circle that it kicked off in first. And we also, if we did get pairs to players, I had no money, so I could afford maybe like half a dozen pairs a month. And I used to do photo shoots and get my mates to buy the pairs to go in the photo shoot. Like there was one player in particular, George Rose in Australia, and he was like the last rotund kind of player left and just a cracking bloke. And every tackle he played for Manly, he would get dacked. And the
what's dacked?
With someone pull your pants down. Oh, okay. Because it's, and you'd see the pairs, and then the commentators got into it and started asking what pair he was going to be wearing, you know, the next week. Can they show him the pairs? And that really helped us. And there was, I mentioned before, like not competing. So we decided not to compete in the swimwear arena. And then the fabric that we chose is like quite different to a Speedo fabric. And it's actually meant for like long distance triathlon and that sort of thing. And it lasts pretty well in a pool, but it feels like it's almost got like a porcelain feel to it. And so like triathletes can wear it for doing like a full Ironman.
No chafe.
And so that's why I think now you see like rugby and like I see cricketers like playing a whole day in it. And then they're also like just functionally, if you get in an ice bath or whatever at the end of the game, it's easy. So there's a functional aspect to it, as well as, you know, I thought, when I met with Berwick's manager, if I have to pay $10,000 to every person to wear the product, that's going to be very expensive, even at scale. So I need to do this the other way and make a product that the players really like and want to wear. And so that's what I went about doing, and it took like 5 to 10 years.
Dream scenario, though. You think about the authenticity with it, and it's great having you in because I think it's such a great brand, and I know a little bit about the story, but for that authenticity, and you look at the people that are now engaged with it, and I think a large part of it is how fun it is and how humorous it can be. It's almost like turned into a little bit of a community.
Yeah. It's kind of, and you see someone wearing a pair and it does feel like you kind of double look like, oh, you know.
Give the nod.
Yeah, like a polite nod. And, you know, we say we're trying to free the thighs of the world and creating something in our own way. Got a name drop. Artie Sevilla, I was on a call with him the other day. It was maybe 6 months ago or something. He was so funny, like just a super lovely human for how terrifying he is on the field. And he goes, like, Linny Brew, like when I was growing up in New Zealand, like we wouldn't really wear them, eh? We called them Speedos. Like, I wouldn't wear them, but then I put some on the other day. They're really comfy, eh? So I love to play in them. I was like, oh, man. That's probably a terrible accent, but I was like, you know, it's just amazing. Like someone like that appreciates the brand. Like C. Khaleesi came into our store with Etzebeth in Bondi a little while ago.
Well, they're not ordinary rigs. Them three you've just mentioned there, Eben Etzebeth, my goodness me. He'd look $1 million in a pair.
I gave Etzebeth, he loves our underwear, and I gave him a lift home in, and I've got a Subaru, which is like Forrester, which is like a pretty big car. And so I gave him a lift to the hotel in, they were staying in Coogee, and his knees were like, like he took up 3/4 of the car, and like, lovely chap. I was like, what are you up to? Like, what do you like outside of rugby? And he was like, you know, love my family and stuff. And he was about to get, preparing to get married as well. And he's like, but to tell you the truth, Ninny, I just really like my rugby, eh? Like, that's my main focus at the moment. And I'm like, fuck, that's a guy I'd want to play with. Like, he is committed. But then also, like, all the South Africans I find are pretty, they've got a bit of a wild streak in them as well. Yeah. Like, they're kind of seem a bit serious. And I remember going to the Exeter dressing room one day, maybe like 4 years ago, and there was a big redheaded South African bloke with a beard.
Kurtzen.
It might be him. And I was like, oh, I don't know if you'll be into him. And he's like, Linny, my friend, give me the most outrageous pair you have, brother. What is the most outrageous pair you have? I'll wear it everywhere. I was like, whoa.
That accent was better than Evans, because Evans sounded a bit a crossover between Kiwi, South African, and a little bit French as well.
Yeah.
But they are, like, the South Africans. I've got a lot of time for South African lads. Actually, me and Eben, I'm going to say it, we're friends. Like, we go back and forth now on the Watt bike and stuff that we do. He's into his Watt bike.
Yeah.
Spent some time with him in Toulon. You know, he has this perception, which it is, on the rugby pitch, a monster, uber aggressive. But he's a sweetheart of a bloke.
Yeah, lovely, lovely fella. And I grew up in a area, like, for a chunk of my childhood that it was like mainly South African kids. I played soccer when I was like 7, and our coach was a guy who was the hooker for Transvaal, which I think
that's proper.
Yeah, his name was George Toledas. And so the parents would like drop the kids off and we'd play like 20 minutes of soccer, and then the parents would leave, go and get a coffee or whatever, and then they'd go, okay, boys, and he'd put a ball at one end, one of you needs to get to here and the rest of you tackle him. And it was like, no, it's just kids flying everywhere. And when he coached the team, he insisted no other parent be on his sideline. And he would walk up and down the ground treating 7-year-olds as if it was like an Olympic final or something. But, I got a lot of time for South African people.
Yeah. So with them, like, you talk a sponsorship deal, if it's a Red Bull for Sia Khaleesi or an Asics for Eben Etzebeth, they're paying a lot of money for that kind of exposure.
Yeah.
But they're loving.
We're like, it's a one that we're trying to like figure out how we make the leap from athletes just wearing it and posting it, because we're not at the stage where like we're going to pay Adidas money. It's not like, it's not within our realms, but then a lot of the players want to do it. So we're just trying to find like the commercial sweet spot there. And then sometimes it's hard, because like, before we came here today, we were speaking with Jack Noel, and he's done all these pairs, and we owe him like a royalty for the pair, and he just refuses to take. He's just like, don't worry about it. And he's like, all right, donate all my royalties to the, I think it's called the Royal Life Saving Services. And he's like, and then I'll use that to buy pairs so they can get even more money. And I'm like, mate, we'll donate the pairs. So you get this like, there's some people who've popped up along the way, like Jack, Adam Ashley Cooper, when he was in France and stuff, who've just like helped us so much. Like,
But that's the brand you've built, and that goes back to it, this fun, energetic, and a community. You can hear the authenticity and the reasons why you're doing it, and I think that that's why people have latched on. I mean, as a chief smuggling officer... Yeah. That's right.
Chief smuggler,
to be sat in a car with Eben Etzebeth, Sia Khaleesi. Let's just say Ardie Stavea was in the boot as well, because that sounds great. But that interaction...
It'd be a good forward pack.
But the people, like the Stoltman brothers, for example, I don't know what your deal is with them as well, but the collaborations that are happening here are now far beyond probably your expectations of where it was going to go.
Yeah, and I think like... part of it for me is like, I don't have another plan. Like, this is it. And so I'm trying to do it in a way, or express through Budgie a way that, you know, I can spend time with people and that sort of believe what we believe and think in similar ways. I was like really lucky in my 20s to spend most of my life with Aboriginal people, and that taught me a lot. Like, in Aboriginal languages, there's no word as please or thank you. So there's like over 200 different Aboriginal languages around Australia, and there's no word as please or thank you. And like, what that kind of means is like, you've got a community and you just need to look after people. And if you do that, like it does come around. And so how that's kind of been expressed through Budgie. So like in our first 5 or 6 years, we raised $250,000 for charity, but like that was about equal to our combined losses over that period of time. And so I think people saw that community kind of nature. And then I think the other thing was when we did send stuff to players, say, it wasn't like that transactional kind of thing, like we'll give you this, can you do this? It was like, here's some pairs, we hope you love the brand, saw your game against so-and-so on the weekend, like good luck in the semifinals, like something like that, rather than here's 5 pairs, can you please do 3 posts, like. And so it's very slow then, like, because people would be like, oh, you've sent all this stuff, no one. But then eventually the people who do believe in the brand start to come through. And, that's what's sort of starting to happen.
Well, we're in the green room just then with Matt Hansen, the Ireland winger. Podcast would have gone out before this one, and saying that he wanted to meet you. So we went for a steak next door and I says, oh, I'm interviewing my mate Linny from Budgie Smuggler. He said, what, as in like the Budgie Smugglers? I said, yeah, as in like the chief smuggler. I said, that's him. And he came, he said, oh, I want to meet him. Didn't he? You had a conversation with him.
Yeah, like, yeah. And that's really cool as well. Like for me, like it works the other way sometimes. Like if people throw a shot at us, I'm like, that's like a personal barb against me. But for the most part, like everything's so positive that, it makes me enormously proud. And you know, we're trying to build something that means something to people that people care about. It's not just me, you know, we've got a huge team, all my family's involved. I've run out of relatives to employ or to have a part of the business. So, you know, my mum, dad, brother, sister, cousins, like everyone's involved. We're sort of all in. So
cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I want to go back to the Aborigine conversation that you just brought up then. So I'm really intrigued by different cultures, especially when you think about Australia and everything's on the outside of the country, or the capital city.
Yeah.
The capital city is Perth, Melbourne, and I've done the East Coast and been Brisbane and all these places.
Yeah.
It's really fascinated me about the vastness of Australia and what's in. And before COVID, I was meant to go and do a feature for Rugby Pass,
yeah,
the Rugby Explorer in Australia. And part of that was spending some time with Aborigine people,
yep,
and looking into it and the research and just how they're built and the lifestyle, and it was just absolutely amazing. So just give me a little bit more insight into what that was like. And Curtly Beale from the Aborigine community as well, yep, he's a big Budgie Smuggler
community
fan as well.
Yeah,
am I saying it right? Aborigine, or Aboriginal?
Aboriginal people, yeah. Aboriginal people. probably the simplest way to go. So to where, go with, so like Aboriginal people, like, so like a short course, I guess. So it's the oldest continuing surviving culture in the world, so like over 40,000 years. So one of the only race to make it through 2 ice ages. There's about 300 different Aboriginal groups from across Australia. So if you think of it like Europe, all those different groups have some like differing customs, differing languages, but you know, a lot of similarities as well. And then there's also Torres Strait Islander people. So they're like the islands off the northeast of Australia, and they're ethnically totally different and culturally quite different, and more the same or similar to people in Papua New Guinea. So that's the rough breakdown. It's a really wonderful culture. I think there's a lot ingrained in Australian culture. Like I was saying, how there's no word as please or thank you in Aboriginal languages. The way like Australian people would say that is, oh, it's swings and roundabouts. Like, don't worry about it. So I think also just the remoteness of Australia and things like that, you learn to have some resourcefulness and a sense of humour. And a lot of that is very evident when you spend time in Aboriginal communities.
And what's like the weather specifically? I'm stating the obvious here. So if they're living inland in these communities, are they tribes or communities?
Yeah, both. Yeah.
Yeah. So how far inland and what kind of resources are they lacking in?
So the whole, like today or?
Yeah, I imagine it's more, there's a lot more happening for them now and they're probably up to date with a lot of the stuff. But I mean, how rural is it out there?
So actually the majority of Aboriginal people live in like kind of major urban and regional areas, but you wouldn't really notice it as much. So I think Sydney has the highest population, but it's like 60,000 Aboriginal people out of a population of 5 or 6 million.
Mm.
So it's like 1%. So if you go to more regional areas, that changes. Say the Northern Territory, I think it's about 30% Indigenous people. And there's battles there as well. Like there's some in Central Australia at the moment, some big problems with drugs and alcohol.
In Central Australia?
In Central Australia, like Alice Springs. But at the same time, there's actually just like so many, it's hard because the media likes to portray like the worst of the stories. There's so many positive stories. It's the highest rates of Year 12 completion that we've ever had in Australia for Aboriginal people. So,
and what's that score?
That's your A-levels,
yeah,
I guess.
A-levels, yeah.
So there's actually a really strong generation coming through, but at the same time, there's some of the things that the government or whatever has done to try and help. Like there was the introduction of welfare in the 1970s in Australia. So before that, a lot of Aboriginal people were paid less than non-Aboriginal people. And then they introduced welfare, which was like well-meaning, but people started getting paid more to not work than to work, called like sit-down money. So Aboriginal people have been at the heart of regional Australia, you know, forever. But that actually caused a lot of problems because then in the 70s, people, you know, it's called sit-down money. You get paid more money not to work than to work. So what was well-meaning actually led, and if you're not working, like you don't have a purpose, drugs, alcohol, all these things start to become more prevalent than they were because it wasn't nearly as much of an option prior to that.
I'm really interested to go back to Australia. I'd love to spend a bit more time. We've got the World Cup there in 4 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So definitely, if you're going to the World Cup, get to some regional and remote areas. Like you must go to the Northern Territory. Like it is fucking wild. You can do a helicopter pub crawl.
I ain't doing a helicopter. That ain't happening. I'm not doing it. Can I do it on my motorbike or not? Can I do it on a Harley? Or is it too
hot?
You could
get around on your Harley, but to get to, so I didn't actually realize like how big it is out there, but on the map, Alice Springs is quite close to Uluru, which is the rock in Central Australia. Yeah. So I went there with a girlfriend at the time and we arrived at like 3 and I was like, oh, well, we'll just pop out for the rock for a couple of nights. And I got to the airport and she was like, oh, just be careful. There's a lot of like wildlife and kangaroos and stuff on the road. I'm like, no dramas. And then I'm like, how far is it? Like 45 minutes. She's like, it's 500 kilometers. It's like something like that. So Uluru from Sydney, you drive west, I think through Albury. It's kind of above Adelaide. It's about a 26-hour drive or something like that. Yeah, it's a long.
Service stations on the way?
Yeah, there's a few. Yeah, I think you could get there in two days if you
put your foot down.
If you pushed it, or it's about a 2.5 hour flight. I think it's sort of be about 2,000 kilometers, and then from there it's another 2,000 to Perth, which would be the next town over 30,000 people.
Australia is so big. It's so big.
It's a similar size to Europe or continental United States. Yeah, yeah. She's a big place. But and then you mentioned before, like half the people live in 3 cities, like Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne. So it's got kind of this aura of like the outback, but most people now live in big metropolitan. It's one of the more urbanized countries in the world.
What am I seeing on the way? I'm doing this, by the way. So whether or not it's in next year, 2 years, or leading up to the World Cup, I'm going in a car,
yeah,
cross country, outback, cowboy boots, cowboy hat.
So I would, do you want to start cowboy or finish cowboy?
I'm going to start. I probably ain't going to finish cowboy. I'm going to be hanging by the end of it. So let me start cowboy. Great pictures, and then I'm going to be buggered by the end.
Start. You would start cowboy. My wife's uncle did this the other day. He was like a jackaroo, which they work on the farms in the Northern Territory. They're like huge farms. Like it'll take you like 3 days to drive across the farm, like 200 kilometers wide, sort of thing. Like just like they muster the cattle in helicopters because it's just. It's just that big. But you'd start in Darwin, you'd go remote like Kakadu. There's these beautiful gorges there where like you're in the kind of the desert, there's shrubs and stuff, and you climb up these rocks and you're like, I bet there's going to be nothing there. And then you get there and there's just this beautiful free-flowing waterfalls that you can swim in. And if you
hang
go
on,
up-
Hang on, wait. So you can we're not swimming in them. There's crocodiles, is there?
There's freshwater crocodiles.
Oh gosh, I nearly fainted when you said it.
The freshwater crocodiles can't kill you. They're little, so you'll be all right. You don't want to mess with the saltwater crocodiles. And sometimes if it's rained a lot, they might make it further up the mountain. But generally, if you're climbing up the mountain, the crocodiles, they find it hard to get up there, right?
So the way to test it is to taste if the water's fresh. And if it's salty, don't go in.
If it's salty, I'd like, don't go in. And like around Darwin Harbour, you're having like a beautiful picnic and there's some pools and stuff and there's fences because there's crocodiles like right up to the
to the
fences. So yeah, so I definitely start in Kakadu. You can, if you like fishing, there's amazing like Barra and like I did a tour there like 15 years ago or something, and there was blokes, we were on this like big boat, like a tourist boat for all the tourists, and then there is blokes like barefoot in these tiny tinnies just catching, like pulling in these mad barra. But I'm like, there's just crocs going by them that are 3-4 meters big, and like sometimes it doesn't work out for them, so we lose.
What do you mean?
Well, that like someone will fall in and get taken, but it's like a once a year kind of, once every 2 year kind of thing. It's not, they're not just. Sometimes there's been a couple of times where they'll be down the main street, but not that's not very common.
Keep going inland. Tell me more.
Keep going inland. So you probably go like, fuck, it's a long way to Alice. You probably go to around to Mount Isa, then come in through central or north Queensland, and then you're back into, I think I heard a story about you jet skiing in
Airlie Beach.
Yeah. So that's like, there you're getting a good combination of, it's incredibly beautiful. It's there's some more people. Like Darwin is one of the loosest, like wildest cities in Australia. I remember going there, I got in at like 11 or 12 on a Monday night, and I thought, oh, everything's going to be shut. Will the hotel be open? And I went down the main street, and everything was just heaving because it's the only town within like a 15-20 hour drive. And so all the backpackers use that as a base. There's a big military base. There's a big university or decent sized university. So it's just like 24/7, pretty wild. And then you get to the East Coast and then just make your way down from Airlie Beach, Fraser Island. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I've heard of Fraser Island.
So it's the biggest.
You can stay there overnight, can't you?
You can. There's a resort on it. It's the largest sand island in the world. I think it's about 160 k's long or something. Mm. It's a big island, and the quickest changing of like wildlife, but flora and fauna. So it goes from like beach to shrub to forest to a full rainforest in like 400 meters. And so you've got all the different wildlife through those phases. And then you come to this beautiful Smith Lake, and it's like a beautiful clear water, fresh lake. There's a stream that you can like tube down, and then you can drink the water straight from the stream. It's just
anything
awesome.
In there?
Nah, it's so clean that there's no fish.
Why did you pause?
Hey?
You just paused when I said, you just paused slightly when I asked.
Is there anything in there?
Yeah, is there anything? There's nothing in that one.
No, but my auntie lived there for, like, it was in the 70s, and there's dingoes.
Mm.
They used to come and steal their stuff, and then no one swims at the beach because of the sharks. Like, you won't see anyone surfing there. So, but most of the other beaches in Australia, there's Western Australia, there's a couple of shark attacks a year. Northern New South Wales, there's a couple. But Sydney, I used to say there's never, the last death from a shark was in the 60s, but fortunately someone died last year.
Yeah, I saw it on the news. That was in Sydney, wasn't it?
Yeah. But Sydney's pretty safe. I do a swim each morning from, not every morning, but when I'm in my hometown in Manly, from Manly to Shelley. And I always said it's so safe, and a bloke got bitten by a shark the other day, but it was unlucky. His hand actually went into the shark's kind of mouth. It was a smallish shark, and it's bit him, and he just bandied it up, and he was back swimming 2 days later. So.
I just don't get how you can do that. Can you see anything? Like, you got goggles on, or you just...
Yeah, I wear these big goggles so you can see everything. There's heaps of fish, and most of the sharks that we see are only this big. So.
And you're not bothered if you see them sharks, you're not?
Not if it's this big, no. And most of them are like wobbegong. They're like reef sharks, so they kind of look not particularly threatening. Yeah, I don't worry about it too much, but there's some places where it's more remote and you're on your own, and there's bigger sharks, and it does play on your mind, and I don't hang out there longer than I have to.
I had this thing about living in Australia, and it is the wildlife that freaks me out, and the spiders. I don't mind spiders, but it's just, have this thought of the kids playing by the beach and a saltwater crocodile comes out and grabs them. They are some scary things. Like, they look like dinosaurs. It's creating, like, now we live in the UK, I live in Edinburgh, and what we moan about is the wind and the rain. That's it.
I love once a year there'll be a little crocodile that gets onto the streets of Cairns or someone, and there'll be some bloke in thongs running along with a shopping bag or something to try and just holding it while the proper wildlife people come. But no, I grew up in Sydney, and it's a great city. It's a bit of a unicorn city to live in, because the natural, it's a big enough city that there's heaps of work and jobs and events, and it's interesting enough, but the natural, you wake up most of the time, the air's clean, the sky's blue, you can go fishing at any of the beaches, and you can eat what you catch, in a lot of big cities in Europe isn't a possibility. So it's a pretty cool place to grow up. But in saying that, I spent 4 years here in London, and definitely recommend that. And then I'm moved across to Bordeaux now, so that's a pretty good city too.
Yeah, it's brilliant. We'll come on to that. Just on the living in Australia, and I was chatting to my mate about it, because it's been a long winter. It has in the UK, in Scotland especially. And when the sky is blue, it doesn't need to be sunny, just needs to be blue. Like, you feel better. Like, your mood is better, your mental health is better. And I was chatting to my mate who lives in Australia. I was like, how good is it? And he said that but mental health in men in Australia is so high. And I was like, as in terms of what he said, it's like there's a crisis going on in Australia with men's mental health at the minute. That's what he said.
Which
I was like, well, you've got the outdoors, you've got the good food, the sun shining virtually all the time. So there is this kind of fake idea, I suppose, that weather and mood and these things have a real effect on people. But Australia's a bit of a crisis, isn't there?
It's got... I know that we have one of the highest rates of youth male suicide.
Yes, that was a stat that I saw, Lindy. I didn't want to say it because I wasn't sure.
In the world? Yeah. So I don't know why that is. Maybe it's too good.
Yeah.
It's definitely an issue that's kind of been happening for a long time. So I don't know what it is, if we can't express ourselves, or use of drugs and alcohol is particularly high. Anecdotally, doesn't look crazily different to the UK, but we do have really high, and there seems to be pockets, the central coast, which is an hour and a bit north of Sydney. That's like the highest, like one of the highest in the world. Unfortunately, a lot of Aboriginal communities, it's really high as well. So
I know it's pretty dark. It was an interesting take.
Because like, you know, employment levels and stuff are pretty good. Social cohesion is pretty good. It's not without issues, but like it is high, and in some pockets, it's just like through the roof. Yeah.
I think I might have seen the stat around male suicide in Australia. We even struggled to talk about it. You can't even say the words, can you? Like, but I think Movember, and they were spawned from Australia. Movember were as well, weren't they?
Yeah, that's an Australian
brand, if you want to call it. But it's a charity.
Brand or concept or fundraising group that's been like incredibly successful in that space. And there's definitely been quite a lot, like, the conversation's changed a lot. I think here as well, it's definitely happening as well, that people are talking about it more. So I don't know what the stats like for the last 5 years are, say, compared to 15 years ago, but definitely there was a strong period there where those rates were crazy in Australia.
Yeah, crazy. Sorry to bring the tone down, but look, you know, we should be able to talk about it.
I think it's good. Like,
well, it's our demographic. It's our age group, isn't it?
Yeah. Like,
we don't talk about these things. But when I look at Budgie Smuggler and I look at the energy, and you think about the people involved in that community, it would go hand in hand with the struggles, like it just would, and the type of characters that are involved in them circles, the rugby clubs, the Jack the Lads, the ones that don't speak.
Yeah, and I think it's important we kind of can talk about these things. Like, I had a really tough year last year. Like, a few different things happened at the one time, and I don't think it was any one thing in my life that was – I haven't really talked about this sort of before, but any one thing in my life that – on its own was bad, but there was like a few things I mentioned to you before that I had a really, this is going to sound funny, but a really badly infected finger. And I was on antibiotics for about a month. And I went into the doctor like the third time to kind of pop it. And she was like, mate, you need to go straight to hospital. So I went to hospital and they're like, mate, it's been going on for a month. So they ripped my fingernail off. And then they put me on a drip, like antibiotic drip for two or three days.
Well, how bad was it? Like, how bad was it for them to rip your fingernail off and put you on a drip?
My finger looked like a golf ball.
Okay, how did you do it?
This is embarrassing. I was biting my nails, which...
Stress.
Stress.
That's the start. This is the start of it.
It was the stress. So so that happened. I remember like a week, 3 or 4 days after that, my guts were... My wife had told me, like, take probiotic. You need to do all this stuff to protect your gut health. I said, I've got a gut of steel. Like, nothing can break my gut. The IV drip broke my gut. I was terrible. Like, I'd have to, like, shit 10 times a day. I remember one time I was just at the office and my sister asked me, like, a simple question, like, what are you up to for the weekend? I was like, I couldn't answer. I was, like, just about to cry. And so something physically happened to me there, which, like, took a while to mend. I just had a kid. That was amazing. But then he was sort of like maybe becoming 8, 9 months. And there's a big shift, like people out there who are new parents or fathers, like when they start to need your attention and stuff a lot. And so that was just a factor in my life. We had the wettest period ever in the history of the East Coast of Australia. Like, so business-wise, it started, like, things started to, everything had grown like 30%, 50%. And so all my budgeting and stuff was based on that. We bought a warehouse, and then so I outlaid a lot of money on that. And when we went to pay for it, the bank goes 2 weeks before, like, sorry, we need another million dollars. I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, we want another million cash. And I'm like, well, that's basically everything that I've got, and they're like, yeah, well, we want more security because the valuations come in less. And so no one thing was like probably would have got me, but I was rattled, Jim. Like, I was fucking rattled. And then every day I'd wake up, torrential rain, people, like, Sydney flooded 5 times. It's probably flooded 5 times in my life. And then, you know, and then you're like, and then I'm feeling bad because I'm like, fuck, these people are losing their homes. I'm okay. But, like, I'm about to run out of money, and my mum is sort of my accountant, and dad sat us down, and they're like, mate, if this keeps going, you're gonna be down $1 million. And like, they were like, we could help you like a bit, but like maybe 100 or 200, we can't give you $1 million, so you're gonna need to fix this situation pretty quick. And the combination of things, like I was checking the sales like 5 times a day, like it's not healthy. Checking my bank account like 3 or 4 times a day, like it was a battle. And I wasn't depressed or anything like that, but just like a constant anxiousness or anxiety. And so even though I could probably hold it together to put on like a bit of a brave face, like I was struggling for a solid. And I think some of the health things, family stuff, like probably like all added up through that period. And then we would just kind of, I had to make some changes. I hadn't really run Budgie Smuggler like a business. It was like, I just assume that we're going to grow 30% every year, give people pay right as much as I could, right? Like,
it was a venture.
It was a venture. It was an expensive hobby for a long time, was how my friends like to describe it. But yeah, we had a pretty rough year, and like we had to make some changes. Unfortunately, like our first ever redundancy and like things like that took a mental toll. And yeah, like fortunately, through like just a combination of sort of luck and hard work, things started to turn, and we made enough changes that by the skin of our teeth got through last summer. And then now, like, I still don't feel like I am like 100% back to like full health. Like,
full Linny.
Full Linny. And like, I don't know, maybe I'm taking a bit on. Like, I'm living in a foreign country, which I love. And there's 5,900 wineries within and out. Like, life's pretty fucking good, right? But you know, and there's like probably some business stresses, and then our kids, he's 2 now, we got another baby on the way. So just some things, like you don't have like sleep like I used to. So maybe the recovery and stuff's good, but I was like at 40 or 50%, Linny, I'm feeling it like 85, 90. Like life's good, but not quite as, I'm still not like, that gut of steel or whatever. It's like nothing could like faze me before. And now, like, a couple of times I'm like, oh, fuck, like, that's getting me upset, or I'm worried about that, where it was like almost nothing could faze me. Now it's, I can get rattled a little bit easier, but I think I'm coming through it, like, just basic stuff, looking after my health and that a bit better. You know, just, like, if you can just do simple things, like, get off the piss, get up and exercise each day, eat well, like it sounds simple. Easiest day or hardest day to start is like, you know, that first day. Then I've got a lot more capacity. And sometimes I think maybe I've just got to come to terms with like life's different. You got a kid, you got this, you can't go and have 10 beers 2-3 nights a week. You know, like,
How old are you now?
I just turned 38.
Yeah. And that, I mean, it is it's a tough age.
And an age thing maybe as well. Like,
yeah. But I think when you're in this age group, I've just turned 40 and I've got 4 kids, but you're trying to manage and you're trying to balance, and then you're hard on yourselves the whole time. You said you function at 85%. I think that's a bloody, you're never going to be at 100%. I think understanding that, and I've got to the point now, and this transition, hell of a word, out of rugby.
Yeah.
I think back, I retired at 34, so just over 5 years ago. I look at how easy my life was. I had 2 children, and I think kids are the hardest thing.
Yeah.
I think as a man as well, the responsibility that you have, and a woman, obviously.
Yeah.
But as a man, when you are purpose-led, adrenaline, testosterone fueled, if you're an alpha male, not that if you're not an alpha, then you wouldn't feel these same things. But then when you get into the line of business or performance, or like in my case, transition out of a career into no other career, I've fallen into the media, then pressures, like they're heavy, like they can weigh heavy. And I do think that kids, and I know that kids are a huge part of that because of the responsibility that you have. You're also battling the whole time with yourself about how much time you want to spend with your kids. You need to spend too much time. Oh, I've spent too much time with them. I need to spend more time on my business or growing my podcast or growing budgie smuggler. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I'm thinking about work when I'm at home. So you're constantly putting pressure on yourself all the time, yeah. and then trying to find that balance and that peace within yourself is really difficult because we're both sat here, not saying that we are Elon Musk and bloody Joe Rogan,
yeah.
but we're trying to make something of ourselves by pushing ourselves out of our comfort zone, and that has a stress on top of it.
And that's it. I am trying to like push it at a firm pace because if, you know, budgie can grow, like it provides like opportunities for our team. Like if we get stagnant and it, again, like I don't have a plan B, so this one's got to...
But that's why it will work.
Got to work.
That's why it will, because you don't have a plan B.
I think so. Like so many of the decisions that we've made along the way, so I haven't taken on any investment like ever. And I think part of it was because like it might weaken you a little bit, you know, if you've got like a house and like you're pretty set. So I like that there's still a grind. And we're probably not going to grow 5 or 10 times in 2 or 3 years. But if that takes us 5 or 6 or 7 years, like that's okay. Like I enjoy that. I kind of enjoy a little bit, like, it's a bit ridiculous, you know, like that this, you know, brand selling swimwear that no one was really wearing is like kind of, and gets voted the most like disliked item of clothing, hated, I believe was the word, in the UK can have a business here in the UK, in France and these different places, and loving meeting people and stuff along the way. Like there's a great social aspect to it for me, but I think we're at a scale now, like we sell a pair of smugglers every 2 minutes. And so that's at a volume now where it's like I've got to run it as a bit more of a business and not like before. I was running it as a hobby and we nearly got into trouble where the whole fucking thing collapsed and living in that emergency flight or fight mode. So just for me trying to find that gear where it's like we're working hard to go forward, but also so that I don't break or that the business doesn't break.
Yeah, that feeling of feeling uncomfortable can sometimes be a nice place because that does drive you. And I've felt very uncomfortable in my life before, very uncomfortable. And now I feel comfortable and I challenge myself all the time because I am more comfortable than I've ever been.
Yeah.
And it's not like sometimes it's not like I don't need to get out of bed to drive from the Cotswolds to Saracens in my last year while I was transitioning at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
I'm not doing 5 jobs like I was in my last year at Saracens because I didn't know what I was going to do. I'm more comfortable now than I've ever been. And sometimes I battle with that.
Yeah. I think on the comfort thing, like I heard you talking the other day about the different like generations of like families and that, and I was like, oh, I've just like been very fortunate that my mum, I like, had, you know, I'd say fairly, she's from Poland, she grew up in a house like in a room on the outskirts of Warsaw, like they had no toilet, so you had to go outside. It was -20. I think now she says it's -50, like it's getting 10 degrees
it got tougher.
And I had a shower the other day and I'm at this Airbnb in Bordeaux in France, and I get out and I there was a fucking heated towel rack and I don't have one of them. I put this on. I was like, how good is my life? I was like, this is amazing. Like I have the most like a fucking heated towel rack. Like, whoa, like my life is amazing. So I think, I'm in a position of like comfort in some respects. And then there's just this, like, I don't know, like drive that you want things to keep progressing. And I get, don't know if impatient is the word, but like I feel this like pressing need to keep trying to move things forward. And if it's not happening at the right pace, there is a bit of like inbuilt anxiety or frustration that comes in. And then, yeah, when you add in the family element, like if you can spend time with your kid or kids and have a clear mind, it is just the most amazing experience. Like it's like what life should be.
Exactly.
But it's the fucking opposite. If you're like
not present, it's called.
Not present, or like your kid's woking up at 3 a.m. in the morning, you're like, fuck, I've got this much on, like, it spirals on you on the other way. So I haven't quite found the sweet spot there where I can allocate my time. Like, it sounds a bit functional, transactional, so that like I can be a good dad and a good partner, and then also have the mental like sharpness when I'm at budgie as well.
Yeah, I think that's with life at the minute, where there are these struggles, because I don't think it's necessarily about having a number of things or not having a purpose. I've come to the point now where I genuinely feel like the phone and social media and that constant stimulation, and I've tried and errored because I'm in a personal development phase at the minute. I'm unapologetic about that. I'm trying to find out what my direction is and how the balance and how my life balance in them spaces works for me.
Mm.
And I have come to the fact now, and it is obvious because everyone speaks about it, but being on the phone before bed.
Do you ever bring your phone to the toilet with you?
Yes.
That's when I knew I had a problem.
Mm.
Like, if you're bringing, anyone out there, if you're bringing, that's your thinking time.
Mm.
That is your thinking. That used to be a sacred space where you could go and think. And now I wouldn't be surprised if most people listening bringing their phone to that. I was at a cafe this morning and just looking at people having lunch, but on their phones. And I'm like, we're losing the ability to be bored or lost in thought.
And to look up.
To look up, yeah. And fuck, like, I just feel like the engineers at Google and Facebook and whatever, they're like so much smarter than my ability. So I've had to take most of I'm not terrible. I've never had an Instagram or a Twitter account, so that helps. But I do have the budgie one on my phone, and sometimes I pepper people after a few beers, just treating it like a personal commentary on a game going on or something. But I also noticed that if my screen time is the higher it is, like the more anxious, like actually physically my chest feels tight.
Mm.
And I think part of that's like the physical holding of the phone. But in our warehouse, as an example, the average screen time is about eight and a half hours. And some of them are doing an 8-hour shift. So I don't know exactly.
How do you know this? Have you asked them to share screen time?
I just like not like some sort of military thing where they got to show us.
Just a bit of banter to open up the
phone.
Just
a bit of banter, and like I think everything, you know, TikTok's the where they're spending 80% of their time.
And it's I like TikTok as a platform. It has good things on there, but a lot of it is trash.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's a form of entertainment, but like high on passing time without satisfying you, I think. Like,
well, you think about if you go on there, you come away from it. So say you're in bed the night before and you're flicking on your phone. When you wake up in the morning, are you at what point, unless you've seen something horrible or a lion decapitating a gazelle, or you've seen something like that pop up, or these I watch these fight videos, which are quite good, actually. They're quite funny. Some of them are pretty gnarly, but you're not waking up in the morning thinking, right, that was worth it. Me lying in bed last night, flicking on my phone mindlessly.
Yeah.
I've gained anything at all.
No, so I've had to like, yeah, just physically just not have them, and then the barrier to downloading them is too high because, yeah, I've never woken up a day in my life and gone, oh, geez, I wish I spent 3 hours on TikTok today. So I'm going the other way. I want to try and get rid of I'd like to not even have like an email, like just be good if you could just pick up the phone and call. So trying to find the right balance, but the whole like comparing people on Instagram sort of thing, like no one posts pictures of themselves just like, here's me at a public toilet. Like everything's got to be amazing, living my best life. Like no one posts living my most average life. Or if they do, it's at the total end of the spectrum where it's like, oh, I am breaking down. And so it's just this distorted perception. And you know, maybe in 5, 10, 20, 30 years, we'll figure it out. But the technology is way ahead of our ability to deal with it or any regulation. There is no regulation. Like, it's pretty funny. Like the tech guys are like, we'll regulate it.
Oh, it's crazy. But like, you're absolutely right. I cannot believe that kids are open to looking at some of these videos on TikTok. And my kids go on, they're not on TikTok, categorically not. But I looked over my 12-year-old lad's shoulder, he's on Snapchat, and he's pulling funny faces and sending it. But his head's down constantly. I'm like, JJ, put your head back.
Yeah.
Put your shoulders back. Look up. So we have this thing, like there's no phones ever at the dinner table. The phones are gone. I say, I mean, this is part of my business, isn't it? So part of it is publishing stuff. There's my excuse. But at 8 o'clock, they're gone, none in bed. And in the morning, like me and my wife alternate training. So before we've been on the phone, and we try and show the kids, like instead of telling them the whole time, you have to show them that you're doing it as well.
Yeah.
If I'm making excuses that, oh, you know, I've got my head down on the phone, on the sofa, and it's so easily done, but it is a cultural shift.
Yeah, no,
for humanity and society, it's crazy.
We do a similar thing, like so 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. phones off, so we put it physically, like not in our rooms, and then people are like, oh, but you need an alarm clock. It's like you can buy an alarm clock, or we just set the alarm, and it's out of the room, and when you wake up in the morning, you go out and get it. But yeah, try to build some habits where you're not the temptation's like, yeah, just like. Physically put the barrier there, it helps.
And that's where life is too easy. I, across the board, yes, there are struggles, but stuff like that, as in it's too easy.
Mm.
It's too easy to keep picking your phone up, put it down. Where's my phone? I need it for this. I need it for that. I need the alarm clock. I need to know the time. I've got important messages coming through, emails.
Yeah.
I'm telling you now, I've done it before. I've left my phone at home for 3 days or at the weekend.
How did you feel at the end?
Weird. And this is me being completely honest at the beginning, very weird, constantly
going,
you know, even when I was in the car, like I'd be patting my pockets. I have no idea why. And it takes, I'd say half a day to a day. And then once you get through that, and again, it is the obvious thing. If you can do it for 2 or 3 days, it feels unbelievable. And I know, again, it's easier said than done, but people should give it a go. And training. I'd say that training's a number one thing for, again, stating the obvious, but mental health. I'm chatting to Goody about this. Goody's trying to lose a bit of weight at the minute.
How's he doing?
Yeah, not great. Not great. But he can operate at a certain level. And I'm just like, mate, you need to.
Yeah.
At some point, you've got to.
And like same, I went.
Go
I,
there.
I went to the gym just before here tonight, if you can't tell.
I can.
And like 2/3 of the people were on their phones in the gym. And I was going to bring my phone in. I'm like, and listened to a podcast, and I was like, nah, like, I was on a flight this morning listening to one, like, just leave your phone in the...
That's great mental resilience that you can do that. Because training with no music or headphones is quite hard as well, but it's a good thing to do.
I was like, I had an idea, and then you're like, oh, I need to write it down. You're like, mate, just, you'll be able to remember it.
Mm.
I fucking totally forgot them. But
yeah, but training is a big one. Like, that's for me. And my wife's like, why are you training like that? Like, you don't need to do that. And I was like, that's the thing. I do.
Yeah.
I need to hammer myself for 20 minutes, half an hour. And off the back of that, my clarity and the haze disappears.
Yeah, absolutely. Like if I am feeling like anxiety, whatever's getting on top of me, and it's just, I just quit the piss totally and get up and train, give that a go for 4 or 5 days.
Number one cure, right?
And then after like 2 or 3 days, I'm like, oh no, Lindy's coming back.
He's thirsty.
You can deal with this. It's Thursday.
Yeah.
Yep. Pub anyone?
But it's fine. You can have that balance. But if you can roll out of bed on a Monday and just hammer yourself.
Yeah.
And put yourself in a bit of a hole. I'm telling you now, you feel amazing.
Couldn't agree more.
France. So you now, is this a comfort blanket or is this business decision?
No, this is like probably the opposite. This is kind of a little bit of a keep pushing yourself, personal development, Jim Hamilton kind of thing. Like it's kind of be easy for us to stay in Manly in Sydney where we live, but it's like let's keep pushing the boat out and developing. So my wife and I, like, we've chucked ourselves into French school trying to learn the language. And then Budgie Smuggler goes pretty well in France. We've been based in the UK. We've had an office here for 6 odd years, 7 years maybe. But 40% of it's going into France. So, and then like since Brexit, it's become a bit of a fuck stick for shipping, duties, all of that stuff. So it's reached a scale now where, yeah, I've been back like building shelves, building desks. We've just got a lease and we're opening French-based website on the 4th of June.
And you're going to base yourself there? I mean, the World Cup's there. Is that an opportunity or not?
Mad sore point. So not a sore point, but that was the original plan. And then my wife and I said, oh, we'll start trying for a baby. And we're very lucky. We've got a second baby on the way that's due on the first game of the World Cup. So we'll be going back to Australia for that. And
for the baby?
For the baby. And then we'll so I'm spending sort of 4 months in France to get it set up this year. And then I'll be back, I hope, for another 4 or 5 months next year to really, you know, like for me, there's a saying, you can't get milk from a cow by sending an email. And it's like, you can't do everything by remote control. You need to, or online, you need to go and meet with people. You need to live in a place, to live here in London and travel around the UK to now live in France. And so the south and southwest of France, kind of rugby areas, are our most popular areas. So we're set up in Bordeaux because it's like 2 hour train to Paris, 2 hours to Toulouse, 2 hours to Biarritz, which are the sort of main key kind of smuggling areas for us. And then it's like, it's a good life experience as well, right? Like it'd be easier to do it from Sydney where we know everything and things are monotonous, but I think my wife Liz and I are like pretty keen to just try and keep accumulating experiences. I wrote to Matt Gitto's wife Bianca before. I was like, oh, what about like having a baby in France? And she was like, mate, just get on the plane. It's amazing. Get the fuck there. So everyone was super encouraging. Adam, Ashley Cooper, I mentioned before, played in Bordeaux. He's like, mate, here's a triangle, like live somewhere there and just trust me, go and do it. So that's what we've done. We've been there two months. The people in Bordeaux, like it's really friendly place because it's a mid-sized city. I think like the city itself's maybe 300,000 or 400,000. The broader area is like 1 million. So there's heaps to do, but it's at a scale where people, you can get to know people at the bars and cafes and stuff like that. So we are loving it.
Yeah. I mean, if you can make it in France, we were talking about this with all the administrative challenges, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah. Well, I was saying before, like one of the first rules for us is like, don't compete. So there's not a lot of, most Australian swimwear brands try and, or clothing brands, the target's the US. And so we're just going a different route. I like being a little bit, I don't know, not contrarian, but just finding the path that works for us. And at Budgie, we always want to look after the people that look after us. And like we had the first French event for Ordinary Rig. It was called Monsieur Ordinaire. And like the...
Mr. Ordinary.
Yeah,
there Jim. We go. I know. It took me a second just
Parler
to pick
le français.
C'était bien pour moi.
So the entrance in that were just out of this world. So the first... So we've had a guy, Gibbo, who's been working with us, Guillaume, for a couple of years, who's been great. And our next hire, it's like, do we hire someone with like experience running an online business in marketing, et cetera? It's like, how about Monsieur Ordinaire? So Nicola, he's our second employee there. So it's just the two boys and myself. My brother's coming across from Australia on Thursday to help set up the website. And then, yeah, a week and a bit after that, off we go. And like, yeah, you know, I sense there that it's a place that they really get Budgie Smuggler and the ethos, and they're really up for a good time. So I think I'm pretty hopeful.
Oh, it'll definitely take off. I can see it. I can feel your energy in here today and the smile on your face for sure. Before you go,
yeah,
I'm going to put you on the spot here. So top three smugglers or smugglettes that you've got in the family where you're like, that is so cool. Either that they're wearing the Budgies or that they're part of the community in the family. You mentioned Jack Knoll, so you can't have him, but that's pretty cool.
Okay.
His story.
Yeah, Jack Knoll's amazing. Funny story. Well, okay, so seeing it pop up, Lewis Hamilton buying them for his teammates on like the last season of Drive to Survive, that was pretty cool. Even though I'm Australian and I should only support Australian cricket, which I do, Stokes, when he scored the 135, and Headingley was, I think it was Headingley, was wearing smugglers. So, like, I was like, fuck, like, it's cool, but geez, it hurt me on the time. And talk about anxiety, like, me watching the Australian, like, national teams playing sport, I am just, my blood pressure's out of control. But that was a tough day, but a beautiful one. And then we got an order from the royal family for Christmas, which was customs, which was pretty funny. That, like,
come on, you can share it. I can see you holding back. What was it? What did they order? Smugglers for Kate or not?
I think maybe. But
or Zara.
I think it might have been customs. It was custom swimwear. So, like, about a third of what we sell is custom swimwear. I think it was Mike's head on pairs. And then George is here with us today at the studio. I called him up and I'm like, what did you charge him? And he goes, oh mate, it's the royal family. We didn't charge him anything. I was like, what the? I go, mate, have you seen their houses?
Yeah, richest family.
have you seen their house
in the world?
I'm like, oh mate. But anyway, to be fair to them, they didn't ask for any discounts and they offered to pay it. He was like, no. I was like, all right. We'll let it go. Hopefully they'll shop again with us next year. But yeah, I think probably what I like about that is, like, it's very different. Like Formula One, the royal family, cricket, they're all different, like, communities. And so maybe what I love about it is that people from all those different backgrounds are embracing it in their own way and finding some ownership of it. So that's just something that gives me a lot of joy.
Mate, it's brilliant. I give a shout out then to your website and social medias before, because I think it's a brilliant brand. I've said that to be a small part of the Budgie Smuggler family is brilliant. Makes people laugh, smile, the community that you've built, the authenticity around it. Give a shout out to
BudgieSmugglerUK.com is probably the best one for your audience, and sign up to the mailing list, because when there's new stuff coming, you'll get it first.
We've got some followers in Australia as well, but they know about Budgie Smugglers. It's the OG, isn't it? It's the heartbeat.
I hope so. Yeah. We're a bit more established there, but it's, we're the gift the royal family gives for Christmas. So, you know, maybe we've got a future here as well.
I reckon we're going to see Prince William and Kate on a boat in Marseille wearing a pair of Budgie Smugglers with Tinsley's head on.
That would be pretty. I know. I think it would send things, like, it would send the media going nuts.
It would, yeah. Let's make it happen.
So get his face on your...
Yeah, let's do that. William, he's a big listener of the show. Kate definitely listens. I know Tins does. Big shout out to you. Lenny, class mate. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, Jim. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll do it again in the future. What, keep smuggling.
Keep smuggling. That's the one.
Cheers, mate.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.